You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the China Shop. Hope you're having a good new year so far. I'm Shopkeeper Dan. With me, as always, is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm doing good. I'm excited for today. We've got a really good guest on the docket.
Yes. Going to be a fun, exciting day today. Kyle, you want to introduce our guest?
We have Jared Bibler. Am I saying that right, Jared?
That's right. Yep.
He's the author of Iceland Secret, which I have been describing as a sort of Wolf of Wall Street story as told from the regulator's side. So let's see. I don't think you just mentioned that you hadn't seen Wolf of Wall Street. So it's
I've seen it. I haven't read it. So yeah. Anyway.
Okay. So the book and the movie kind of follow each other pretty closely.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's, well, first of all, thanks for having me on, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, you're doing us the favor.
Yeah. I think I tried to write a book that people would want to read, and people are telling me they're reading through it, you know, in a night or two nights or something. So that's quite cool.
Oh, that's awesome. So what's the what is the book about then? Let's just jump right into that.
So I was the first investigator. Well, let's just talk about Iceland for a second, because you probably don't know that much about this crisis. And even in Iceland, they've kind of forgotten, because it was
really
2008. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's been over a decade.
Yeah. But for me, it's like I was still living it anyway. So in Iceland, I think we experienced, I was born in the US, but I relocated there when I was about 30 in 2004. Mm-hmm. And it was the craziest boom, you know, it's amazing. If there's a movie made of this book, I think that's going to be the fun part to make, because the boom there was so much crazy things going, there's so many private jets flying into a place that was the size of like a main fishing village.
Really?
It was way over the top, crazy. One of the big businessmen, he flew Elton John in for his 50th birthday party.
Oh my God.
to give you an idea. When I moved there in 2004, Iceland had about 270,000 people. That's the whole country. Mm-hmm. And Reykjavik's the capital. It has about 200,000. So it was a small place, but it had three banks that grew to the size of Enron each.
Oh my gosh. So how does that happen?
Yeah, well, that's, you have to read the book now. They were able to, it's funny, right? If you imagine this, imagine that you lived on an island with a couple hundred thousand people, and your main exports were fish and some smelted aluminum, some energy exports in the form of like melted aluminum and tourism.
They have a lot of gemstones there too, don't they?
Not sure about that.
Or is that Greenland? I might be thinking of Greenland.
Maybe. But, you know, anyway, they went to the Germans, and the Germans, like, I love to say this about Deutsche Bank, you know, they never met a loan they didn't want to give, they didn't want to make. And they're the most profitable. It's crazy about the Germans, because they'll go into a place like Greece. You know, the whole Greece financial crisis was just to save Deutsche Bank.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
I was unaware of that.
Yeah. Well, and also some French banks. Mm-hmm. But these banks were huge lenders. They had bought Greek debt and marked it as, I don't know, AAA. And, you know, they had it as a safe asset, and they were capitalized with Greek debt. And if that had been haircut, even like 10 or 20%, mm-hmm. Those banks would have gone bust, and they would have forced public rescues from the French and German governments. And they didn't want to do that. So they just crushed Greece instead.
Oh my gosh.
That's in the book by Varoufakis. Uh-huh. I'm looking at it now. It's called Adults in the Room. That's a fantastic book. Varoufakis was later the finance minister of Greece, I think in 2015. And he tried to actually renegotiate the terms of the debt so that Greece could escape this prison. And it wasn't successful. Anyway.
Wait, what was the name of that? I need Adults in the Room?
Adults in the Room, yeah. Yeah, so in this case, Iceland had these really, you know, they had been actually government-owned banks, mm-hmm. You know, public banks. One was, and they had like sleepy names. One was called Búnaðarbanki, which literally means like the agriculture bank. And another one was called like Landsbanki, which means like the lands bank. And they were these small, sleepy institutions. They were hurriedly privatized in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And they were basically privatized in the way of, you know, this, you can do privatization in many ways, but this is like crony privatization, where they were just kind of handed, each of the two most powerful political parties took one bank and gave it to their, you know, to their party.
Wow.
You know, it's a businessman from that party, and they just ran with it. And they went quickly figured out that Deutsche Bank and other European lenders would kind of lend them as much as they wanted. And it's funny because, you know, Iceland is, in the public imagination, at least in the German speaking world, it's like this, you know, the Wagner Ring cycle was written based on, you know, Icelandic mythology, mm-hmm. and so on. So it's got this, like, this Thule, this northern, you know, this pure land of the north idea to it. What's funny is that in the rest of the Nordics, they just see Iceland correctly as kind of more like the Wild West.
Right.
So no Scandinavian bank lost anything in the Icelandic crisis, but the Germans, and also eventually US and Canadian pension funds and so on got pulled into this as well. Because these banks, they got huge. I mean, I was looking at the statements for Kuiper thing for the creditors mm-hmm. list. This was a few years after, and it's like, you know, the Iowa teachers, these aren't exact quotes, but I think I have them listed in the book, but it's something like the Iowa teachers retirement system. And the, you know, these are like, you know, reputable Midwestern US sleepy pension funds that lost tens or hundreds of millions sometimes as these banks collapsed.
So how did you get involved with all this then?
Well, I was kind of like, I was working on Wall Street, but not like glamorous Wall Street, not Wolf of Wall Street.
Right.
But like, well, that was like Boiler Room Wall Street, I guess. I was working on the back office side of one of the biggest Wall Street banks mm-hmm. for about 5 years, from 99 to 2004. And, you know, this was fun work at first, but I was completely burned out. We were doing weekend conversions where we'd be working, you know, Saturday, you have to be in the office Saturday morning at 5 a.m. You know,
yeah.
And if you were lucky, you'd get out at 5 p.m. and then Sunday you'd have to be in at 8 a.m. And if you were lucky, you'd get out at 3 p.m. and you'd be like, oh, now it's the weekend, you know,
right.
It's Sunday at 3 p.m. And then Monday morning, you had to be back in there at 7 and another week began. So those were tough years. And I was like, maybe there's a better way. So I got a job in Iceland, just stumbled into a job doing something similar, doing IT consulting work. Mm-hmm. For a nice little Icelandic company, 2004. And so I was there through the boom years, mm-hmm. and I even switched over and worked in one of the banks as an asset manager.
And so
2007 and 8, and that was eye opening because I thought I had, you know, stars in my eyes. I thought, oh, I'm going to be a rock star. This is going to be great. And it was fun. You know, it was cool. It was fun. But I couldn't believe, I was really, after about the first 6 months, I started to lose sleep from that job because the stuff that we were doing with client funds was just terrible. It was just...
Are those details in the book?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm ordering it right now.
So good. Good. But, you know, so I finally got sick of that world and I quit. And my last day was the third of October 2008, a Friday. And the three banks collapsed on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of the next week. So the 6th, 7th, and 9th of October.
Okay.
And so they were each the size of Enron.
I have to ask.
Yes.
So is it a coincidence that the collapse happened right after you got there?
Well, after I left, you mean.
Okay.
Yeah, I pulled it. No, you know...
I don't know if anybody else has put these two pieces together yet.
Yeah, I get that question a lot.
Okay.
I don't have a good answer for you. No, I think, but you know, even look, I in the last few weeks, mm-hmm. this was Lehman collapsed, I think on the 17th of September. So I was there for the 2 weeks after that Lehman collapse. That was pretty shaky times inside that bank.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. But nobody expected the crash to be as deep as it was. Mm-hmm. I thought the banks would have trouble funding and there'd be some difficult, you know, and they'd have some layoffs and stuff. I mean, I thought it would be like that, but nobody expected a complete gutting of the countries. I mean, the stock market lost 97% of its value.
Right.
Whoa.
Unemployment quintupled. And then in the middle of that week or the next week, check this out. The British, Her Majesty's Treasury, on their terrorist watch list. So it was like Al-Qaeda. It was like Al-Qaeda in Syria or Al-Qaeda. It was like these, you know, these famous names of terrorist organizations. And then on there was like Republic of Iceland, Financial Supervisory Authority of Iceland, Central Bank of Iceland. Yeah, really. And that was horrible because they did this to punish the country. Uh-huh. We can get into that if you want. But that basically being on a sanctions watch list, a whole country, that means that no money wires clear.
Right.
None. Yep. Like nobody in the world who... So all the legit businesses in Iceland, of which there are many, especially in the fishery sector or energy sector.
Oh,
they wow. all had invoices outstanding. You know, they had to get cash in, pay their people, you know, for exports and so on. That was just frozen for, I think, 10 weeks, something like
that. So they really kind of screwed like the working class. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the country. So, I mean, I remember the run on the banks happening. Mm-hmm. I remember being in the middle of that. And I remember going to the store. And now when I told this story a couple of years ago, people were like, oh my God. But now with COVID, I think you've seen like, you go to the store and like shelves are bare
yeah.
in the supermarket, but I had never seen that before. So then I got hired. That was a dark, dark winter. Cause I had quit without a job to go to. I was sure I'd get a job at one of the pension funds. And there was nothing.
Right.
The country had just it was really dark. And in Iceland, the winter is dark. Like the sun comes up at 11:20 in December, and it goes down at 3:15 or 3:30 or something. You know, it's just really dark.
Yeah.
And it was metaphorically and literally dark time. And the people of the country just swarmed out into the main squares of Reykjavik, and people were just banging on pots and pans. I'm standing in the snow.
I heard you talking to Anthony too about the conversion to the euro. I can't remember the exact figure. I think it was something from like 97.
Yeah,
of the currency exchange up to like 300, like in the space of a couple of days.
Yeah, I want to say it was in the high 90s. Mm-hmm. So ISK, so 95 ISK would buy you 1 euro. And that was, you know, and this was like, you know, you get these exchange rates in your head. They stick for years, you know. So it was like that, around that range for a while. And then at one point during the collapse, the central bank announced that somehow they were going to peg it at 135 to the euro. And I think that peg lasted maybe a few hours. And then it just slipped down to 200 or something. And then actually they froze then, and they just said, oh. Well, anyway, you couldn't, at one point there wasn't a euro market, you know, you just couldn't buy them.
Right.
So that's it. You don't even know what the rate is. It's like, they're not available.
Guys, almost like they just shut you out from the rest of the world.
Yes. And that was like that. There were capital controls for 8 years, I think.
Wow.
After. Yeah, you could not buy dollars or euros, anything, unless you had an airplane ticket. And then, but this happened. I actually, this is in the book, but right after the crash, I was like, I'm just going to go on a trip just to get currency,
right?
You know? And so I got an airplane ticket, and then I went around to the banks. This was like two weeks after the crash. It was pretty early. I went around to all the banks downtown, and they were just out. No, you couldn't get hard currency anyway, even with an airplane. They just didn't have it. They didn't have physical cash.
That's wild.
I went to France and I went to the ATM every day and I took out like 300 euros, which was the max.
Right. You
know? So I came back with like, I don't know, 12 or 1500 euros in cash. And I was like, this is what we have. You know? Yeah, it was really dark. I can't tell you like that feeling. Cause you don't know when you're in that, you don't know it's going to get better.
Right.
Or it could be better in 5 years, but you know, you have no idea how you're going to maybe feed yourself the next week. And even doing the final research for the book this year or last year, early last year, I realized that, I found out that the complete collapse of the payment system was almost a miracle that it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been even worse than it was. Could have been a lot worse. But it was pretty frightening.
You know, what's the saying? Like, I think people are basically 3 or 4 meals away from complete anarchy.
Yeah. Right. And we lived that. That's definitely true.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one positive thing in Iceland is it's a tight-knit society. And I think that really helped, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think if this type of thing happened, like in the US or some other place that was less so, it would probably have just, it would have been anarchy. And I think Iceland, the central bank, head of the central bank actually used that word in a meeting sometime around that weekend before the banks collapsed. He said, if we don't get an emergency law in place so these banks can wind down, we're looking at 30 years of anarchy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did you get into the regulatory side to start investigating this?
Well, I mean, like, I wanted a job at this point.
Yeah.
even one that paid in local currency would be good, right?
But so, I mean, I'm almost wondering if the regulators just wanted to nail somebody at this point, seeing their country kind of just turn to shit. Did they approach you or did you approach them?
I applied like right away, mm-hmm. and didn't hear anything. And then I didn't start there until 6 months, almost to the day, 6 months after the banks collapsed. It was April, early April of 2009. Mm-hmm. But they had like hundreds of applicants.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they had their pick.
Right.
And they gave us like really difficult. I was doing my CFA at the time, so I was really current on like balance sheet analysis and stuff. But they gave us really hard problems to solve.
Hmm.
And I did well enough on that to be one of the top candidates. And I think they also liked that I was not a native.
Mm-hmm.
Although I speak Icelandic and I had become a citizen by that point, but I was an outsider still,
right.
Definitely. And I think that was the first time that was an advantage for me,
uh-huh.
In Iceland, because otherwise it can be hard to be a foreigner there. People will yell at you on the street and stuff like that. So, yeah, really. Someone told me like go home and stuff. One guy was like, go back to your land, bitch. One guy said on the street. Yeah. Anyway, in English too, it was like, thanks for the.
That's probably the only phrase he ever learned.
So. Yeah. So anyway, I got into the regulator early April 2009, and yeah, they really wanted. I think, you know what though, it was because of the public pressure. They really. I hear a cat over there.
Yeah, it's nice. Close the door.
The cat's Icelandic's telling you to go home.
Right. Yes. Hey, I just read Kafka on the Shore by Murakami. That's got a lot of cats in it. You know this book. No. Anyway, so I got in there at April 2009. And I had been in banking and in IT, banking IT, and had been fund management, and I was working in the CFA. So I had background to do this type of work. I had very good background, but I mean, I'd never done an investigation before. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first day, they were just like, well, here's your desk. And the desk was nice and had like, you know, state-of-the-art Dell, you know, whatever PC with like two screens, you know, and you know, and a phone, you mm-hmm. know, and they were like, well, here you go. This is where you're sitting. And then they were like, well, you know, have fun investigating. It was like, you know,
that's it. That was your orientation.
Yeah, basically. And thankfully the regulator had hired, they had hired the auditing firm. So the big four, I think at least three of the big four have Icelandic outposts. Mm-hmm. And they had hired them to look into, I think the instructions were like, look at the last 2 weeks within each bank and see if there were any suspicious money wires and suspicious trades and so on. So we had report, because this is now 6 months after the crisis. So we had these reports,
mm-hmm.
and that was a place to start. But what I started with was a letter from the stock exchange, and the stock exchange. And this is now we're getting. So everything I've told you is not even the crazy part of the story,
right?
This is the crazy part. I got a letter from the stock exchange, and the letter said, "It was January 2009." So it was from the head of market surveillance at the Icelandic Stock Exchange, which is Nasdaq, mm-hmm. a Nasdaq branded exchange, or owned, I guess. And it was written to the head of securities regulation at the regulator. And it said, hey, we noticed some strange trading patterns on October, I guess it would have been like October 2nd, 3rd, and 6th or something. It was like the last three trading days before the whole collapse happened. And they said, what we noticed is that on these 3 days, one trader at each bank, one broker ID, he bought basically almost 100% of the daily share volume on the Icelandic Stock Exchange in his own bank's shares.
Right.
It's like, You get what I'm saying here? Like one trader buys all the all the volume on the exchange, like for that day.
Just one guy.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. One guy at each bank. And I was like, what? They can't, that's who, if they're doing this with the bank's money, I mean, this is just straight manipulation, you know?
Just basically trying to prop their price up.
Yeah. And I was like, this could be big. Yeah. You know, this is something we should look at. And the lawyer who handed it to me, he's like, yeah, we don't really know what to do with this, Jared. Can you look at this? And I was like, yeah, I'll look at it. You know, this is good stuff. So I went to my boss and I was like, you know, I want to look at this. She said, okay. And I said, well, I need to see these trades. I need to see the data. Mm-hmm. So just to be sure. And I want to look at, just do some analysis on this. Dig into it a little bit. And maybe I'll go back like 2 days, or maybe I'll go back a week and just get the last week and see how it looks. She said, yeah, that's fine. I was like, well, I don't know. How do I get this information? And she says, well, we're the regulator. I don't know. She didn't say that, but it occurred to me as I was asking, I was like, oh, we're the regulator. So it's like, she said, yeah, just call them and tell them what you need and they'll give it to you. So I got an Excel spreadsheet from the stock exchange with all the trades in each bank's shares for those. I think it was the last week.
How big was that
before they were
spreadsheet?
It wasn't even that big. I mean, this is a very small stock market. Although these entities were Enron sized, the stock market itself, I mean, they were the market. That's the other thing. These three banks were 75% of the market cap of the exchange. They were the whole thing. Because if you throw in a couple of the satellite companies, you get maybe 90% of the exchange.
Wow.
And they all, so imagine, this is why the stock market lost 97% of its value, because they were the market. And so I was like, wow, these guys were, and so in the last week, the whole pattern was the same, which is that you have a prop desk trader, so proprietary desk, so with the bank's money, buying, you know, using that bank money to basically buy all the volume as it crosses the exchange. Just like, oh, just, you know, just keep this price up, you know? And so I wanted to see,
I gotta ask, what's the end game on that plan? Like,
yeah.
Do they think they could just keep that up forever?
Well, check this out. So I wanted to see when it started, right? So I was like, oh, maybe they did, you know, this is crazy. This is a big case, I thought. You know, this is, you know, because I wasn't a lawyer, but I could read the Icelandic laws. And I went and looked, this is like market manipulation, pretty straight up. And I had met all the criteria. And I was like, well, you know. And so I call the exchange again. And I'm like, hey, you know, give me 2 weeks of data. And so they do. But it was the same. Mm-hmm. The 2 weeks were the same. So it was at least going on for 2 weeks. So then, I mean, I can't remember. I went back a few steps. Finally, I thought I was being really bold. And I was like, give me 6 months of data, you know, April 2008 to October 2008. I want to see when this begins. You know, this will solve the problem.
Right.
And then it was the same.
Oh, my God. Holy shit.
For 6 months. Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, Jesus, this market was just a mirage. But I couldn't, like, I mean, you guys seem to get it, but I couldn't explain this. People are like, oh, so what? They were just buying some shares. I'm like, no, these guys were creating
them. Creating their own, you know, market.
Yeah, they created it. So then I looked back 5 years, and then I found a point where I could call the beginning, which was like in 2004.
Mm-hmm. Good Lord.
Yeah. It turned out later, as I was doing the research to finish up the book, that actually it went back in some cases as far as 1998, which is before the banks were even fully private.
Holy crap.
So this was like baked into the market. In the market in Iceland, people were fired up about the market. Everyone was talking about the market. It was like every taxi driver was in the market. You know, those years were crazy. And it turned out that the market had just been, you know,
set up, mirage, created. Yeah.
Yeah.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. And then, of course, they used, so you asked, how long did they think they could do this? Well, I guess they thought they could do it forever because they had been doing it forever. And, you know, they used those great share price performance. They used that to go to the Germans, to go to the Americans, and to borrow. So they went to Wall Street. Later, they went even to Japan and borrowed money. And if you look at the presentations, for example, that the Wall Street banks did to pitch their bonds, it's full of share price talk.
Right.
You know, so these guys have a robust and growing and healthy share price and blah blah blah. So, so the whole thing was created, and I think I've never heard of a bigger market abuse case in the world. And this is the three biggest. And they were doing this like, this cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So each of the banks spent about $1 billion just in the last year, just in Iceland, just buying their own shares. You know, this became the, yeah. This is the crazy at the heart of the book. This is the reason, because even though the Icelandic crisis got covered somewhat, it was always lumped in with 2008, and people just assumed that these banks were, you know, drunk on subprime debt or something.
No,
it wasn't the case at all. I mean, they were drunk on their own shares for years before that.
So as big as these banks were, was the 2008 crisis like kind of what led to the unraveling of the whole thing, or were they of the actual catalyst for maybe driving some of the 2008 fall?
No, they weren't that big. Okay. I mean, as big, I always compare them to Enron, which is a bit cheeky because, you know, other banks are much bigger than Enron. Mm-hmm. And banks' balance sheets tend to be pretty huge anyway. Enron was at least nominally a company with some pipelines and stuff. So it tend to be a smaller balance sheet. But anyway, they actually were in trouble. One executive said they were insolvent, the biggest bank was insolvent in 2005 already.
Hmm.
When he got in there, and there was what they called a mini crisis of 2006, where the banks, where the Germans actually decided, this is not such a good, we don't really know what these guys are doing with our money. And they stopped really, the European wholesale markets really closed down at that point. And the bank's shares took a hit. And what's funny about Iceland, but a small country, is whatever happened on the market happened to the currency mm-hmm. at the same time. So if the stock market went down 20%, the currency lost 20% of its value. Also, those things were really, really, really tied.
Right.
So that all happened in 2006, but then they they doubled down then. So 2006 would have been really the time to take stock and maybe, you know, shut some things down, sell some assets.
Right.
But I think they didn't have much good to sell anyway, and so they doubled down.
Well, if there's no buyers, what are they going to sell to?
Yeah, but I mean assets in terms of like they had some good loans on their loan book. You know, they had, you know, they could have, yeah, you know what I mean. But they didn't do that. They continued to grow at the same rate, which was doubling the balance sheet almost every year. They did that for like 3-4 years. It's really Ponzi type of growth.
Did you have any inkling of any of this stuff that was going on while you were working for them?
I had no idea about the shares mm-hmm. thing. I never bought shares in any of the Icelandic, although I knew plenty of people around me did. They were like, everyone was, this is like tulip. I was reading about tulip mania yesterday. And, you know, even women in the brothels were like, you know, were trading tulips. So it was the same with Icelandic bank shares. Everyone in the country was in on this in some way.
You mentioned the taxi drivers talking about it. Like, I think if a taxi driver is talking to you about certain stocks, then that's probably the top.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that's a good rule of thumb.
But actually, it was that way in 2004-05 when I got there. You know, it was already crazy. And then it continued more crazy. So I never bought the bank's shares, but I had my savings in a money market fund, which was offered by Landsbanki, my bank. And guess what that money market fund was? It was, you know, it was lending to some shell companies that were holding the bank. Because we didn't even get to the even crazier part, is like, what did the banks do with the shares once they bought them? Because they couldn't, if they would, like in a typical buyback, you would cancel the shares. Once you buy them, you strike them off, you know, So if you had 11 shares and you buy one back, you strike it off. Now there's only 10 shares. Okay, they didn't do that, because if they had done that, that would necessitate an announcement.
Right.
And then and the amount they would be canceling would be like a quarter of the shares outstanding.
Oh, shit.
You know? So yeah, so they couldn't. So they had to hide them. And that's the even maybe crazier part of this. And the harder thing for me to investigate, actually finding the share buying, it took me like a week or two. I had that whole thing mapped out, but I still didn't believe it, because I was like, where did these shares go?
Right.
Like they're not on their audited financial statements anywhere. You know, it's just like, am I seeing things here? And what they were doing was, like, I already spoiled it, but they, you know, for example, they were hiding them in domestic investment companies, mm-hmm. or even offshore investment companies in the British Virgin Islands or Cyprus or so on. And those companies, where do you think, okay, at some of these trades were huge, because they had to hide them all at the end of each financial quarter to get them off their books. Mm-hmm. So they would do like one, two, three trades, and each trade would be like hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, worth of shares in one block, mm-hmm. going to some company. The type of deal so huge that if it were legit, they would have announced
right.
it, you know, like so-and-so buys 200 million shares, you know, it's like, they didn't, of course. And where do you think these companies that you've never heard of got 200 million bucks?
Hmm.
You have any guesses?
The Germans?
Well, indirectly, the Germans. No, it was the Icelandic banks themselves, because they could lend, see? So they could just make a new loan for that amount, right. and then the asset side of their balance sheet grows by the size of that loan.
Oh my God! So they're
yeah. See,
that makes so. Oh my God!
So it turns out that most of the loans in the last year or two was just for this bullshit.
Holy you know, crap.
Just yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So how many people went to jail for this? Please tell me somebody did at least
two.
I mean, yeah. Very, very low numbers.
Ugh, it's always like that.
And I remember, well, but even now in Iceland, people are saying this was all a mistake. We should never have investigated. Everything was lovely. Oh, it's
no,
like,
what?
It's all, yeah. It's all being wallpapered over. Like,
oh God.
Like my book is not welcome there.
Really? Right.
Yeah. So I couldn't, I talked to a publisher almost a year ago, and I was like, hey, I got this book coming out. It's really fun to read. It's about Iceland, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, that's not the kind of book that we do. You know? And they're like the biggest publisher in Iceland. Iceland publishes more books per capita than any country.
I did not know that.
And it's an extremely literate and book loving place. Mm-hmm. And so they publish anything. She's like, this is not the kind of book that we do.
Wow. You got anything with some smut in it, we'll publish that right away.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, a couple people were sentenced. I think the longest sentence was 5.5 years.
Wow.
And maybe they served, I don't know exactly. It's hard to get this information. I think maybe someone did a year behind bars.
Sounds like, just like Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's such a shame. So how much of this kind of stuff is still going on today?
Well, that's the reason I wrote the book, is because like it's a cute story about Iceland and all, but I kind of think, and readers back me up on this, I kind of think that this is more the way of the world than not.
Right.
The scam in Iceland was pretty, like I've been able to explain it to you in just a few minutes, pretty straightforward, because it's a small place. It's, mm-hmm. you don't need a complicated scheme. Mm-hmm. But I was talking to a senior person at one of the biggest Swiss banks who read the book. He said publicly, I think he said on LinkedIn, like, this sounds very familiar, Jared. And privately, he said to me, you weren't writing about Iceland at all, were you? You were writing about Switzerland. It's like everybody who reads it, they see their own.
Yeah.
I had like Americans like, oh, geez, this is about Wall Street, isn't it? So
have you paid any attention to the last couple of years with is it, I can never pronounce the name right, Credit Suisse,
yeah.
And the Greensill issue?
Yeah, yeah, I know a little bit about that, yeah.
That was one of the companies I worked for before I quit my job last year.
You work for Greensill?
Not for Greensill, for Liberty, the steel, one of the steel companies that the Gupta had purchased.
Okay.
So yeah, I've done a little bit of digging into that one, and some of the stuff that they were doing, I think, was just plain insanity.
Yes.
Have you heard of future prospective invoice loaning? I don't think I'm saying the actual term right, but
oh yeah,
basically so they would sit down with the bank, and they would, the bank would say, who do you think you can sell to? And they would name some companies, and they'd say, okay, how much do you think you would sell to them? And they'd give them a number, and then they'd write them a loan for what they might sell to this person who's never heard of them.
Yeah, whom they have never spoken with before.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, wow. This is great.
Yeah.
Enron could have, this is like way beyond what
they
Enron
could have learned a thing or two.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what I'm describing to you almost feels quaint now with, you know,
right.
how crazy things are around certain cryptocurrencies and stuff. I mean, you know, it's almost like, yeah, it's almost like I would, when I first moved to Iceland, I had a coworker. This is not his real name, but because he hates it when I call him this, he's called Wayne Grow in the book. Wayne Grow is this character from Heat. I don't know if you've seen that.
Heat, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie?
No, it's Al Pacino, Robert De Niro. It's
Val
Michael
Kilmer.
Mann. Yeah, Val Kilmer's in there. So Wayne Grow is played by Kevin Gage. He's this this psychotic like serial killer. Anyway, my friend Wayne Grow, he was the biggest cheerleader I knew when I moved there.
Right.
We worked in the same small software firm, and he was like, Jared, this is going to be great. This is how he talked. He's like, Jared, this is going to be great. These banks are great. Look at this. This is crazy. Because they were going up like basically a couple of percent. The shares are going up a 2-5% a month when I moved there, every month. And he was like, this is just awesome, you know?
Yeah.
And I would always ask him about valuation and like, why do you think? And he's like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. This is going to be great.
Momentum. It's got momentum.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of the part, but I kind of feel like that's the zeitgeist today. Right. I mean, in a way.
I think that just tells you why it's so important to have stop losses in place.
Yeah. True.
Oh yeah. Man. So, when did you move to Switzerland then?
Moved here in 2012. So that's the sad part. I'm telling you the whole story now, but the sad part of the book is that I did the first investigation that I told you about for the biggest bank almost solo. I mean, I had some help to write the criminal referral because my written Icelandic is not university level.
Right.
but in terms of putting the data together about the trades and where the shares ended up and all that, you know, I did that myself. Mm-hmm. And I was really like, please, can I have some help?
Well, kind of sounds like they didn't want to really uncover all this. It's kind of one of those things that they just want to turn a blind eye to and move on. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, that became more and more. I didn't want to see that at first. And that became more and more clear to me. And I finally left. Just a couple of years later, as my whole team was being taken apart from under me.
Oh, I was afraid it was because of that guy who yelled at you in the street.
Oh, no. Okay. I never saw him again.
Okay.
No. I really thought, because even sleepy regulators in Europe have what's called an enforcement division, and the SEC has as well, I believe. And you need, in a regulator, you need some competent investigation team that takes this type of things forward. The Icelandic regulator had never had one. And I was like, look, we can take these, because I ended up getting a few people to help me, which was a fantastic team of people. And I was like telling the bosses, look, we need to keep this team together even after the investigations are over, just to have an enforcement capacity. They didn't agree, nor did they agree that we should continue the investigations at all. So when we were done with like maybe 5 or 10% of the cases, they just shut it down in about 2011 and 2012. So that's when I moved away. Yeah, there was like nothing left for me to do, and I wasn't going to get a job. I was in the banks. If I tried to go back to one of the banks for a job, I was definitely not welcome.
Sorry, I had to kick the cat out. It was getting a little unbearable.
Kick the cat out like it's an Icelandic regulator. Get out of here.
Yeah, I don't know how to speak in Icelandic, so I couldn't swear at it properly, but
there's not even that many swears in Icelandic. Yeah. I had to invent some just to get people to hey, some languages don't have bad words in them.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And so then that means that the people who speak that native language natively, they don't understand the concept of swearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
what do they do when they're mad?
I mean, there's certain words I wouldn't say around my mother-in-law in Iceland, but they're not that bad. It's like helvitis is one. It just means hell. It's, like hellish, right? Kind of. But that's about as bad as it gets. Hmm. And so I had to I had to invent some. I won't repeat them here, but I had to invent some shocking words in Icelandic. Icelandic is a great language, and it's easy to invent a new word by combining old mm-hmm. words, other words. So I invented a couple of swears, and I would just say, look, when you say the F word in English, this is how it would sound to you mm-hmm. in Icelandic. And I would say this word, and people are like, oh my God. And I was like, oh, well, that's how my mom would react if you said that. And they're like, oh, really? Oh my God, I didn't know. But they're like, but they say it in the movies all the time.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm like, yeah, well, that's the movies.
So yeah. One of the things that I thought was kind of interesting when I was listening to your interview with Anthony, they pretty much started you on learning Icelandic, like your day one.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
How long did it actually take you to be able to speak it competently?
I mean, I still can't speak. I did a talk before Christmas. I haven't gone and looked at the comments, but I think they're pretty bad. I did an hour-long talk for the Transparency International of Iceland, mm-hmm. Online, and I think nobody showed up. And but there was a replay online, and I guess people are trashing on my Icelandic. How long did it take me?
Well, it's not good, though. You don't trash somebody who's trying to learn your language.
Yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah.
My first colleagues, including this guy Wayne Grow, I was telling, they really helped me. Mm-hmm. They kind of they would speak a lot of English because people speak very good English there in general. Mm-hmm. But then more and more they would kind of we'd start a conversation in Icelandic and I'd see how far I could get.
Right.
And each week I could get a little further, which is a really cool feeling, you mm-hmm. know? And now, I mean, I can do everything I need to do there, including professional presentations and stuff. But I still don't have all the words at my fingertips that I would right. like, you know, it's still there's always another level, mm-hmm. just like with skiing, you know, just you get to a level and then you're like, oh, there's now there's new things. Like, yeah, anyway, it's like that.
I feel like that with trading.
Yeah.
Except I'm still on the bunny hill.
Yeah. Right.
So what are you doing in Switzerland now then? Are you working for regulators there, or are you just kind of retired and taking it easy?
Well, I mean, this book has been a tremendous amount of work.
I bet.
Especially since it came out in October. Normally I do consulting work here. I have my own one-man consulting firm. Mm-hmm. But a couple of projects fell through last autumn, and I'm really glad they did, because the book came out in October and it's been 60-hour weeks since then, just with interviews and other stuff like that.
So we're glad you took the time out to talk to us.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. yeah, it's nice. Yeah, no, I do consulting. I've been doing a lot of work on greenwashing and sustainable finance, which I think is kind of the new, mm-hmm. the new ripe area for fraud. That which
sounds so sustainable financing? What?
Do you know DWS? I think that's what they're called.
DWS.
It's the Deutsche Bank. Back to Deutsche, my favorite. Yeah. But it's their asset management arm, and they labeled all. I'm exaggerating a bit, but they labeled half of their funds green. these funds are fully whatever, and they didn't. I think there was not much behind that.
Just that they're
the SE
green color.
Yes. And so there was a whistleblower there who left last summer, I want to say, mm-hmm. and the SEC is investigating them, and it could be a big fraud case potentially. Of course, they'll just do a settlement maybe, but I think that's a bold new area, because there's huge, probably not in the US, but huge demand in Europe. Every retail investor wants some climate friendly you know, I think we're starting to go that direction here. Yeah, here the demand is just, it's just tripling every year. People don't want just a straight market index fund. They want the market index fund that's been greened. So they don't want any oil companies, right, or, you know, like, and so the asset management companies are rushing to offer these products, but there's no check on what's actually in them. Or, you know, there's people that people are racing to catch up to check what's in them. And so that's kind of a new area for, you know, for some good investigations, I think.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
I was actually going to write another book, maybe.
Yeah. What about this time, if you don't mind us asking?
I think it might be called America's Secret.
Ah.
That's the, yeah. That's all I'm going to say.
This could be interesting.
Yeah. So that could be the second one. Otherwise, going skiing, that's high on my agenda.
All right. Dan, do you have anything you want to ask?
No, I've just been along for the ride and such a great story. I remember Enron. I was invested in some utilities since we brought them up so many times. And when I say, like, if I'm online on Reddit or I'm talking to somebody in person and I'm like, oh, it's like Enron, like, they blink at me like, what's that?
Yeah, I know.
I'm like,
it was just the 20th anniversary of Enron, right? Last autumn.
Oh, that's it.
And like, when that was unfolding, I was just an Enron junkie, man. I was reading every book, and that was early in my Iceland time. I think The Smartest Guys in the Room, which is my favorite book, probably my favorite business book ever, which is about Enron. I think that came out in 2004. I was reading that, and it was crazy because just a few years later, I was doing my own Enron investigation, which, you know, not everybody gets to do. It was really cool. I mean, the first part of that, as you'll see, most of the book is focused in that investigation, and it was really cool. It was really enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Also, the people that I worked with, there's nothing more fun than a good investigation. It's, you know, it's just fantastic, especially when you're looking for some smoking gun email and you find it, you know, and you find it, and it's even better than you could have dreamed.
Let's rig this market, boys.
Yeah. Yeah. There was actually an email where an executive said, if we stop rigging the market, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is the gist of it. If we stop rigging the market will lose its trust in us.
We've set up some expectations here. We need to fill those expectations.
Yeah, because think about it. If you're buying your own shares every day of every trading day from dawn till dusk, imagine if you would stop. I mean, the banks would collapse the next day. It's amazing how long they could keep this going. Yeah.
Would you call it tapering?
I was just about to draw that.
Yeah, great point. Yes. Yeah, so yes, exactly.
With the Fed purchasing assets since, 2008, like, what kind of similarities do you see between that and what the banks were doing?
There you go.
Maybe right? That's book. It. Do we figure it out?
Shh, don't give away the secret.
You know what's funny, you guys? Like, it's great to talk to you because half the people who read this book, they're like, oh, I learned a lot about the Icelandic banking crisis. It was a fun book. I'm like, yeah, there's a lot more to this story. Right?
You know, it's not just Iceland.
Like, yeah, it's a parable, guys. They're like, what's a parable? Yeah, so.
Can be applied elsewhere.
Yes. No, the Fed, I mean, the Fed's, it's a fantastic point you make.
So
I'm going to use that if it's okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. My question for you that I want to end with, since we're probably getting close to the time where you probably have other people you got to talk to, what do you see as far as, like, the future of the markets going forward? Are you scared for the coming year?
I'm really worried that, you know, well, right back on your point about the Fed, I'm really worried that we've been living in a sort of a fantasy world for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. And some circumstance will come. It may still be five or two, who knows how long this can go, but some circumstance will come along and will prick the bubble, and then we will have a crash that makes 2008 look like a warm up.
Right.
And that's what I'm really worried about. Mm-hmm. Especially the level of fraud in markets is nobody's talking about it. Because that's the thing. Nobody, no country wants to go hard after big market fraud because it will make their those markets less desirable for listings. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of a global race to the bottom. Nobody wants, everyone has a enforcement division and does some stuff to, you know, to have press releases and things.
Right.
But nobody's goal is to have the cleanest market in the world. And that should worry everybody.
No, I think the goal is just to have people believe in it.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is just do enough to keep the faith.
Yes, that's right. But the level of rot is, I think, much bigger than a lot of people realize. And it's been just carried forward for so long. But to leave it on a hopeful note, this could be fixed really quickly.
Just print more money?
Sorry. Imagine if there were some incentives, like on the crime fighting side, to bring in a big case. Like, imagine if my team had been paid. I mean, we didn't need to be paid. We loved the work anyway, but we were bringing in, you know, multi-billion-dollar frauds.
Right.
Imagine if we got a piece of that as a bonus, even like 0.01%, you know.
Right.
But there's nobody that I know is, I think only Singapore is paying their regulator a market rate. That's the first thing you need for your regulator staff is they have to be paid what they'd be paid in a bank.
Right.
Otherwise, they're going to
go work for a bank.
Otherwise, they're going to go work for a bank. And the problem with that is while they're at the regulator, they're not going to regulate that bank either.
No, because they want to get hired there.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is on the banking side, you have an incentive to do, if you do a $100 million deal, you get a piece of that. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like that on the other side.
Right.
If we had just a little, Charlie Munger who said, like, I think not an exact quote, but show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome, basically.
That's a good quote.
So, you know, like if you just had a few more incentives on the anti-financial crime side, mm-hmm. things could get clean really fast. I mean, I think like this Elizabeth Holmes verdict is excellent, mm-hmm. yeah. right? I mean, people are saying,
she did get found guilty, right? Did I see that right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. four out of 11 counts. Yeah, yeah. And so that was, I've followed that one. That was my new Enron. I was following that a lot.
Me too.
And, you know...
I have some questions to ask you about that then before we let you go.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Do you think she got pregnant during the time leading up to the trial to try to gain sympathy from the jury? Is she that kind of diabolical of a person?
I don't know her at all. I know that some, what's the word, like legal case watchers were speculating the same thing. I mean, they said it was a pretty good ploy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's too cynical.
Yeah, I know.
But
I'm a cynical person.
Well, the lady lowers her voice an octave.
Yes.
Talk. So I won't put anything past her.
To sound like Steve Jobs.
I wouldn't put anything past her.
But you know who else did that? Is Margaret Thatcher.
What?
Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher dropped her voice.
Did she wear black turtlenecks too? Or?
She wore the 80s equivalent, I think. I think she wore pantsuits, which is the same. I think women in power, they often do this. Mm-hmm. She Elizabeth Holmes,
that whole story was just insane to me.
Yeah, the you know, there's some parallels, Stephen, to my investigations. Like, she faked these, and apparently this was something the jury really latched onto. You know, she faked these reports, or she wrote reports for Pfizer, mm-hmm. that Theranos had written the report, the text of the report, and Pfizer said, yeah, that's about right or something. And then she appended Pfizer's logo to the report and sent it to her investors.
Oh.
You know, I saw stuff like that in the Iceland. Actually, what I saw, which was crazy, was after the Icelandic banks had collapsed, they had been in the middle of some really shady deals to try to hide some things offshore just in case they collapsed, mm-hmm. To try to move money So the biggest bank type thing, and I learned this, this is not in the book. I learned this since from another book that I read. The biggest bank had an active project to try to move all the most valuable assets to their Luxembourg bank, which had a Luxembourg private bank. Uh-huh. And they wanted to keep that going as a lifeboat, basically. Let the Icelandic bank just tank and move to Luxembourg and just keep going there with this bank. So they had, they were trying to move the most valuable assets across to Luxembourg and the other junk back the other way to Iceland and let the Icelandic bank sink.
That sounds like Locus.
And they forged documents. So they didn't have signed agreements for all these deals that they were trying to do. They were just moving stuff, you know, really fast in the last days. So they then later, they even though the CEOs had left mm-hmm. and the top guys had left, they still had loyal people on the inside. And the loyal people would dummy up documents and email them at their, you know, at their Gmail or whatever and say, hey, sign this. And the document would be dated like 3 months before, you know. So
wow.
That's kind of a parallel, I guess, with Theranos. But.
Two people we talked to are doing the same shady things. Two instances that we just listened to here, like that just makes you wonder how widespread everything is.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it's quite widespread. I'm sorry to tell you.
Yeah.
Okay, because again, there's no incentive to we only find out, like I actually wrote a little piece about this, about Theranos. It was the month before, I think the trial started in September, Theranos trial. My book came out in October. So I wrote a little piece about Theranos and about financial crime. You know, what should give us pause is like, there's no system. When we uncover a Madoff or a Theranos or Icelandic banks, these are not uncovered systematically by some elite crime fighting, you know, squad, you know, SWAT team or something. All of these things are uncovered like piecemeal because like in Madoff's case, he turned himself in, you know, or in Theranos case, there was a whistleblower who went to John Carreyrou at the Wall Street Journal and told the story. Yeah. That's Tyler Schultz. And you know, Icelandic banks, it's like, okay, they finally collapsed under their own weight because of external factors. But how these great scams or Enron, right, is like Bethany McLean writes a story, I think in Fortune, and it's kind of like the subtext of the story is like, how does Enron make money? And like nobody can answer the question because it wasn't making money, right? Yeah. And then like within 6 months, the company has collapsed. So, but all these things are like one-offs. So how much more, to your question, like how much more is there? Because they're not being uncovered systemically. There's not auditors blowing the whistle, for example.
Right.
That would be their job. They're not doing
right.
it. So how much more is there? That's something to keep you up in that, I guess.
Yes. should we wrap this up, Dan?
Everybody getting cash, folks. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Well, the problem is it could be
gold,
5 years from now.
Yeah, buy gold, buy silver.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Jared, where can the people find you then? We got Iceland Secret. Looks like it's available on Amazon.
It's you can go to the website too. It's icelandsecret.com, two S's in the middle. And you can see all different buying options there. Amazon, you can get it on Audible. Actually, I read it.
Ooh.
So you can listen to me reading it on Audible.
Oh, see that? Wow, we love it when the authors do that.
And you got Kindle and all that stuff.
The website, is that where the piece that you wrote, can they find that there or is that somewhere else?
Yeah, on the media, there's a media tab on the website. Okay. And I try to keep that updated with articles and
Excellent. All right, Dan, you want to take us home?
Okay, well, thanks for sticking around to the end with us, folks. Big thanks to Jared. This has been a great interview. We really appreciate your time. I want to let you know how glad we are.
Thanks to you both.
And we'll be back at you soon with another episode. But until then, happy trades.
Bye, folks. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2BullsInAChinaShop.com. Make sure you check us out, download us on any streaming network, blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.